from Diamond Pharmacy and Optics. This is Podcast RX with Chris Bender. When he's not on the mic, Chris is a clinical pharmacist with the Office of Pharmacy Therapeutics and Integrated Clinical Services, or Optics. He routinely helps providers in correctional and long-term care facilities make better medication decisions to improve patient care. And we're so happy that he's sharing his expertise with you.
Hoping that today can be a real knowledge booster.
A classic Batman and Robin or Jordan and Pippin type scenario.
A full armamentarium of options that clinicians can choose from.
After two jam-packed episodes dedicated to disease states, we're back for a corrections-focused look at medication non-adherence. While the failure to take medication as prescribed affects patient outcomes across every healthcare setting, Chris zeroes in on the unique societal factors that drive non-adherence behind bars. He gives us a rundown of clinical pharmacist strategies to promote adherence, from basic regimen changes to more in-depth counseling and education for patients and providers alike. All this, plus the usual grab bag of medication news, and some trivia about the very first long-acting injectable medications. I'm Adam Campbell, and this is Podcast RX with Chris Bender.
Chris, good to be back with you again, but this time you're sitting right across the table from me.
Yeah, it's good to be in-house, good to get a little FaceTime, and it's nice. I like this setup better than the one I have at home.
I like that you're here too. I mean, as good as it is, I'll come up here and it's very lonely when I'm recording and I'm just talking to somebody on the other end of a Microsoft Teams connection. So
exactly.
The real connection happens here, but it's good to be back with you again. I understand that after we record this here in a few days, your life's going to change a lot for the good.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So we are expecting our second child this Friday. So what, we're like four days out. So, you know, after the pod, maybe, you know, fill me in what number two is like. I figured just going from one to two, it's just throwing another one in the mix. So
it is. It's when you go from two to three.
Then you're outnumbered.
Right. That's the life I'm living right now. But I'm incredibly excited for you and your family.
Thank you.
Yeah. And you don't know what you're having.
Nope,
you're a minority that way.
Yeah. We did that with our first as well. And it's super fun being in the delivery room, because then they hold them up like Simba and they're like, hey, dad, yell out what it is. And it's super early in the morning. And I just remember thinking, don't mess this part up.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that'd be pretty hard to mess up, I'd think.
Yeah, exactly. So,
but either way, that's so awesome. We're excited for the Bender family.
Well, thank you.
And then when we get back in here next time, we'll have to catch up on all that.
So. Exactly. Yep.
But looking back at our last two episodes, you know, we were focusing on disease states, and those got to be some pretty big lumbering episodes with a long-term care focus, but also just, you know, it's very tough to distill those concepts, osteoporosis, insomnia, down to just some real, you know, slim talking points.
Right.
When you're going into the medication. So this month we're switching back out of that mode. We're going to go back into the corrections focused discussions, and we're really going to get into some nuts and bolts issues, Chris, that you deal with most as a clinician and educator for Optics. And today we're going to talk about today we're going to talk about the impact of medication non-adherence in the correctional setting. So looking forward to getting into that, asking you some questions. And just some housekeeping here. A reminder, if you like what we do here at Podcast RX with Chris Bender, please make sure you're following us where you get your podcasts. If possible, leave a review, write us a review. You can also get in touch directly via email. We've got a dedicated email for that, podcastrx@diamondpharmacy.com. And just as another reminder, we post full show notes with links to everything that we discuss in an episode as each one's published. You go to diamondpharmacy.com/resources/blog, and you'll see each month there, you'll have a full write-up of the show and links to everything that Chris talks about. So, but before we get into our discussion on medication non-adherence, we got to look, of course, at the latest medication headlines of interest to practitioners. So let's walk down the hall and go into the clinic.
All right, so let's go. So to start us off, we had a notable new drug approval, Yeztugo, for HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP for shorthand. Yeztugo is the brand name for lenacapavir, which was already approved for HIV treatment and was sold under the brand name Sunlenca. So Yeztugo's approval was based on the Purpose 1 and 2 trials, which compared lenacapavir every 6 months versus emtricitabine tenofovir, which is also known as Truvada. Purpose 1 included high-risk adolescent girls and young women, and it showed prevention rates of 100% and 98.2% for Yeztugo and Truvada, respectively. While in Purpose 2, this one included cisgender men and transgender or gender non-binary persons and showed prevention rates of 99.9% and 99%, respectively. Now, those rates appear very similar on its face. But it's important to highlight that those efficacy rates are among those individuals who actually remained adherent to therapy throughout the trial. It should be noted that adherence rates dropped substantially throughout both trials for those taking Truvada, which is typically, which is pretty typical what you see for a daily regimen, a concept which, of course, is applicable to our today's discussion. So with this approval, there are now 4 FDA-approved options for PrEP. There are 2 daily pills, Truvada and Descovy, and 2 injectables, Apretude and Yeztugo. There are, of course, some key differences among these. So Truvada is the cheapest, given its availability as a generic now. Descovy is limited by the fact that it's not indicated for those at risk from receptive vaginal sex. Apretude is an injection given every 2 months, and Yeztugo is an injection given every 6 months. So we certainly have some cheaper options. We have some more convenient options in terms of dosing and promoting adherence and whatnot there. So it's very exciting to see more, as I like to say, options in the armamentarium.
Absolutely. And cheaper and convenient ones at that.
Yeah, exactly. So we can kind of reach a more broad patient population, especially as we see utilization of PrEP kind of continuing to increase for the good. Now, in other news, SAMHSA released a guideline regarding the treatment of opioid use disorder in prisons. Now, in it, they endorse using all 3 FDA-approved medications. So those include methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone, with methadone and buprenorphine being identified as the most effective in reducing opioid use, overdose, and recidivism. Additionally, the guideline stresses the importance of expanding access to methadone, assessing individuals for opioid use disorder upon intake, preventing medication diversion, and coordinating care pre-release in order to ensure continuity of treatment in the community. Now, just as a general note on this, this guideline is nothing groundbreaking. It's more or less SAMHSA coming out and saying, thou shalt do to the prison system. Nothing really changed in terms of the overall mechanics of opioid use disorder or the overall recommendations of how to treat and whatnot. And I think that actually is something that we discussed in one of our previous episodes.
Exactly. You read my mind. Exactly. When I saw that you were mentioning this here, I did want to recommend to listeners that it's an old episode, but it's still very relevant. And I think they would enjoy that you give that full-on introduction to medication-assisted treatment. And you talk about each of those approved medications and how they work. Right. So again, you can find that in the archives if you go back to episode 5 from August of 2019, you know, a lifetime ago. But I thought that you really knocked it out of the park with how you introduced all that. And I believe Ashley, my colleague, hosted that one
in the day. She did. And hopefully I've come a little bit of ways from that. That was my first episode ever being on the podcast.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, it's certainly still a great primer for anyone who needs an understanding of medication-assisted treatment. So awesome.
Exactly. So in other guidance, this one from across the pond, the UK's Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency recommended that GLP-1 medications not be taken during pregnancy or just before trying to get pregnant. They recommend stopping semaglutide 2 months prior to pregnancy, tirzepatide 1 month prior, and they note that liraglutide can simply be stopped at pregnancy given the fact that it has a fairly short half-life in comparison to the other two. They also note that given tirzepatide's propensity to diminish the effect of oral contraceptives, those taking tirzepatide should use barrier backup protection for 4 weeks after starting, as well as 4 weeks after each dose increase. Now, of course, alternatively, individuals could switch to non-oral forms of birth control like IUDs, implants, or even injections. And finally, the FDA has required the prescribing information for scopolamine patches, which is a medication commonly used for motion sickness, to include a warning regarding the risk of body temperature increases and heat-related complications. This, of course, is not exclusive to scopolamine, as many medications can actually increase the risk of heat-related illness and complications, most notably being anticholinergics, antipsychotics, as well as diuretics.
Well, thinking about motion sickness and heat sensitivity, that's reminding me that I'm going on a road trip to the beach next week. So, you know, you're having a baby. I'm going to the beach next week. So, but on a more serious programming note, just as I did a little bit earlier, listeners should go back to episode 44, where Chris does a deep dive on heat-related complications of medications. You also talk about drug-induced photosensitivity and the like. So that is also a good one if you're understanding it. It's way more, when you did that episode, it's way more of a broad impact than I thought would be.
Yeah, and it's very surprising to see how many medications. Now, some of them are lower risk than others, of course, but it's a pretty broad umbrella of medications that can have an impact both from photosensitivity and heat-related illness. So I highly recommend giving it a quick listen at least.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Everyone knows that pharmacists dispense medication, but the clinical pharmacists in Diamond Pharmacy's optics team dispense more potent resources: information and education. The optics pharmacists are frontline medication experts for Diamond's many institutional partners. Whether you work as a provider in corrections or long-term care, the optics team is standing by to answer your on-demand medication questions. But optics is far more than a drug information hotline. They also create proactive knowledge resources like webinars and this podcast to keep partners up to speed with the latest drug developments. And they help providers to better manage costs and therapeutic outcomes with their in-house medication surveillance monitoring program. Learn more about the optics team by going to diamondpharmacy.com and clicking the clinical support tab. See pharmacy care more clearly with optics. Let's get back to Podcast RX.
Okay, so medication non-adherence. Any quick Googling or AI prompting of this topic always highlights some troubling statistics on the sheer health and financial costs of failing to take medications as prescribed. The most oft-cited numbers include 125,000 deaths annually and $300 billion in avoidable healthcare costs. Interestingly, these numbers were cited well over a decade ago, so there's a good chance these figures could be higher today. You know, there's many factors at play when people don't take their meds as prescribed. There's cost, unclear instructions. Sometimes it just comes down to memory, especially if you're on a complex medication regimen. Now, Chris, these numbers reflect that we're talking the population at large. But when you get into jails and prisons, now you've got a whole new set of factors to consider. So today, I really want you to help us understand these correction-specific factors and what clinical pharmacists like yourself can do to help improve adherence overall in that patient population. So just to get our discussion going, to tie back what I just said, do you have any specific stats that speak to the impact of non-adherence in the correction setting?
Yeah, well, you know, as you and our listeners know from our previous discussions, you know, good data in the correction space is often limited. Mm-hmm. So, you know, unfortunately, I wasn't able to find many specific stats with regard to that space. Now, that being said, it's estimated that 30 to 50% of the incarcerated population is non-adherence. Now, this, of course, may be drawing off of general population estimates, given that the number is actually kind of similar to those estimates that we see in the community. But what we need to keep in mind is that chronic infectious diseases like HIV, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and mental illnesses are more prevalent in the incarcerated population than the general population, which in some cases can lead to increased rates of non-adherence along with larger negative impacts overall. Now, in the case of mental illness, non-adherence may be more prevalent given patients' lack of insight into their own need for treatment, such as in the case of schizophrenia, which we can commonly see. It can also be due to a lack of desire for treatment, as in the case of acute manic conditions, and even a sense of general apathy, which we can see in the case of depression. Now, in some cases of mental illness, there may also be a general skepticism toward the healthcare team, which can also drive non-adherence. In any case, non-adherence in mental illness among incarcerated persons has been associated with violent behavior towards others, greater frequency of hospitalizations, longer prison sentences, and higher rates of recidivism. Now, in the case of chronic infectious diseases, while these don't inherently increase one's risk of non-adherence, the result of non-adherence can be more impactful. They can lead to viral resistance and ultimately treatment failure. This not only increases the individual's risk of morbidity and mortality, but of course also increases the risk of transmission both in the correctional facility as well as the community upon their release.
Well, let's just take a very basic look here. What does medication non-adherence tend to look like in correction settings? And what are some of the primary environmental factors, in addition to what you just talked about, that are driving that's driving non-adherence among patients?
Yeah, so the correctional environment is really like its own separate society, but in many ways it mirrors the outside community when it comes to non-adherence, in the fact that it's really a multifactorial issue, like you kind of led the pod with. Individuals may have their own personal beliefs when it comes to medications, whether it be their perceived need for treatment or perhaps the stigma surrounding treatment for things like mental health or HIV or even substance use disorder. In other cases, individuals may have concerns about the side effects of medications. And this, of course, is most notable in corrections with the antipsychotics, with their potential for sedation, weight gain, and extrapyramidal symptoms, which can range anywhere from restlessness and muscle twitches to the more severe tardive dyskinesia. Another commonality between corrections and community is inconvenience, right? So in the community, some individuals may scoff at the idea of waiting in those long pharmacy lines to pick up their prescriptions. Well, in corrections, medications are given at set times of day where individuals have to wait in line to receive their medications, called pill call. For some, this may be seen as a burden and obviously a reason to avoid taking their medications entirely. There are, however, some factors that are kind of unique to the correctional environment. Individuals often move between facilities or simply just go out for the day to attend court. This movement in and of itself can result in unintentional episodes of missed doses, which I wouldn't necessarily consider non-adherence, but could be impactful nonetheless, depending on what's being treated. But one other factor that I hadn't considered and found interesting while preparing for this episode actually was an anecdote from an individual who swore off medications entirely. And this was because out of fear of his medications causing a false positive on urine drug screens, which are occasionally performed in the correctional setting.
Yeah, and that's an interesting anecdote and definitely a fear specific to that environment. Mm-hmm. You don't want to do anything to put yourself at risk for longer incarceration.
Yes, exactly.
When you get into the correctional care team and you start, you get to the pharmacy role where you're at, what are the strategies then that you're deploying to take on this issue of non-adherence in patients?
Yeah, so one strategy is to provide patient education. So in doing so, we explain the benefits of a patient's medication while comparing that with the risk of letting that underlying condition go untreated. So to do this, we often employ what is referred to as motivational interviewing, in which the healthcare provider and patient discuss the treatment in a more collaborative fashion by asking the patient questions that ultimately seek to draw out the patient's own motivations for change, rather than the provider imposing external reasons. So it's more less paternalistic and more all-encompassing. So a good example of this would be a patient unwilling to treat their uncontrolled diabetes because, you know, to them, it doesn't really bother them and they don't really feel like remembering to take their medication. So through motivational interviewing, we can empathize with the patient's situation while at the same time informing them of their long-term risks of uncontrolled diabetes like neuropathy, amputation, kidney disease, and even premature death. You know, in moving forward in the conversation, it may also uncover that they have a newborn grandchild, and they may ultimately serve as a reason for them to consider, you know, their long-term health, such as being able to physically play with the grandchild and being around for them as long as they can as they grow up.
Yeah. And it's interesting that it's called motivational interviewing, which that's exactly what it is. But it's also really an enhanced form of pharmacist counseling, what we would think of.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's something that we've been seeing more in the recent, you know, recent years, decade or so. It like I said, it's less paternalistic and saying you need to take this medication because everyone's because one person's because is not the same as another person's because.
Exactly. And how much overall experience have you had with that now being with Optics as long as you have?
You know, it's interesting because in the correctional setting, we don't have as much direct involvement with patients. But I also, too, can find this when discussing with providers because there is sometimes apprehension to use some medications, perhaps due to costs and whatnot. But you can also employ this with providers as well and kind of their motivation is often to minimize costs moving forward. And a lot of the times the discussion is you could not use this medication right now and save money here. But if your true motivation is to save money in the long term and avoid a large hospital bill post patient send out, it would perhaps be better to use this medication up front and kind of give them the optimal care. Now, this was something that I did get to employ a lot more frequently whenever I worked in retail prior to my life here at Diamond, as well as when working in home infusion before working at Diamond as well, because that was more of an antimicrobial infection type driven environment, the home infusion was. And there were often patients who you're dealing with PICC lines and IV bags, and there were often patients who didn't want to kind of mess around with that kind of stuff, but you kind of had to meet them where they were and find out their motivations, anything to kind of help them become more motivated to use their medication.
Yeah. And just overall interesting as your, you know, with your career arc, you did the patient and provider side to do that motivational interviewing on either is really interesting.
Yeah. It's never limited to just one individual population. So yeah,
for sure.
So another thing we can do is help patients set expectations, both with regard to a medication's effectiveness as well as potential side effects. So it's important for patients to understand that in some cases, a medication cannot completely eliminate symptoms. So let's take neuropathic pain, for example. So the medications we commonly use for this condition, things like duloxetine, nortriptyline, gabapentin, pregabalin, they really only reduce symptoms by about 50%. So, you know, if a patient is going into therapy expecting 100% resolution of symptoms but only gets 50%, they're probably going to stop taking the medication. But if they understand going into it that the goal is really to get them to a more tolerable level with overall improved function, then they're often more likely to continue with the medication. Likewise, with adverse effects, if a patient understands that a particular medication may cause a particular adverse effect, they can usually prepare for this, and they can often take steps to either counteract it or in some cases, simply take comfort in the fact that it may only be a temporary effect, as some are. So take, for example, the GLP-1 agonists. I know we talk about these all the time, but they're a great example. These most notably cause GI effects, as our listeners are probably well aware. We're looking at things like nausea, vomiting, constipation, diarrhea. If the patient understands this before they start the therapy or before they do a dose escalation, they can take comfort in knowing that these are often temporary, but they could also mitigate these effects by doing things like eating smaller meals and eating more slowly. So it's all about setting expectations. We as a whole don't like to go into things without knowing things. Right. It's often a lot more of a slap in the face whenever you're blindsided by something. So the more a patient knows, in one way can be a little bit scary because if you've ever picked up a patient pamphlet from, you know, Walgreens or something like that, it lists everything under the sun and that could be scary. But if patients are aware of the very common things and what to expect with them, you kind of like you're more well prepared to handle that. Mm-hmm. So another strategy is to simplify patients' medication regimens. So this may involve switching the time of day a patient is taken or a medication is taken, switching to a medication that can be given once daily rather than two or three times daily, switching from a daily medication to a long-acting injectable medication like what we were talking about with the new PrEP injectable, or even just eliminating unnecessary medications if we can entirely. And of course, for those in the community, this may involve establishing daily reminders to take medications or to establish the use of daily pill boxes. That, of course, is more limited to the community, given right. that it's not as, you know, pill boxes and apps and whatnot are not right. prominent in the correctional environment.
Right. And as you said, and as listeners know, that you know that you're not in that direct patient care role, but I would imagine, though, that these practical moves, like you just detailed, the simplifying the regimens, that's a big, big part of what you're recommending to providers.
Oh, yeah. A lot of times.
Yeah. So you've been with Optix quite a few years now. How many, again, remind me, we talk about this, you know, every so often.
Like, oh, boy. Optix since 2018. Oh, so okay. I think 7 years.
7 years, right.
Yeah.
So talk about your process for educating providers in matters of non-adherence.
Yeah. So a lot of my interactions with providers are obviously more reactive in nature, where they either reach out to me regarding a non-adherent patient, or we identify an order that has been ordered incorrectly to compensate for a patient's non-adherence. So it's really at this point where I basically recommend that the provider meet the patient where they are. So a really good example of this that we get a lot is with Eliquis, which, as a reminder, must be given twice a day. I've seen many cases in which the patient has difficulty making it to morning pill call. So the provider will change the order to once daily at bedtime to kind of compensate for the patient's typical dosing habits. Now, it's important to remember this is inappropriate both from an efficacy as well as provider liability perspective. Because if the patient were to have an event, the provider could appear liable for prescribing a medication once daily when it must be given twice daily. So for these cases, I actually recommend switching the patient to a once daily anticoagulant like Xarelto so that the patient can get the full effect of the medication while they only need to take it once a day. Not a specific endorsement for Xarelto, but it serves as a really good case example of meeting the patient where they are in an appropriate fashion. And other times, it involves an acknowledgement of the provider wanting to help the patient with adherence, but they're not really sure how to properly achieve this. So a good example of this recently was actually a patient who was not taking their daily levothyroxine or Synthroid for hypothyroidism. Now, fortunately, levothyroxine can actually be taken once a week. So you simply add up all of their daily doses and give them all at once on a singular day of the week. However, in this case, the patient was a bit combative, so we were told. So we ultimately decided it best to give a once weekly intramuscular injection of levothyroxine at 75% of the total weekly oral dose, which is appropriate, which is an appropriate thing to do as well. So this just kind of gives you some decent examples of how it's kind of fun and interesting kind of working your way around non-adherence, because there's usually more than one way to do things. And it really allows you to kind of put your thinking cap on and play around with different ways that you can address this issue.
Well, we know that from your work with Optix, we know that clinical pharmacists are being incorporated more into care teams and addressing issues like non-adherence. That being said, because you're getting more medication expertise that way, what do you think the overall state of non-adherence is in corrections? Do you think it's improving, staying the same? And where do you think the greatest impact can be still made with this issue?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. Just like in the outside community, I think adherence rates remain stable for the most part, simply because, you know, in all honesty, we humans are kind of complicated beings, and it's always going to be impossible to reach 100% adherence. Now, that being said, I do think the corrections as a whole is improving with regard to understanding the importance of adherence and their motivation to improve patients' adherence. This has been particularly noticeable in the increasing uptake of the long-acting injectables for HIV, bipolar, schizophrenia, and substance use disorder. Now, given the lower adherence rates of individuals with these conditions and the higher severity of outcomes associated with non-adherence in individuals with these conditions, we are starting to see providers opt for the long-acting injectables as a way to not only improve adherence within the facility, but theoretically also upon transition back into the community. So the long-acting injectables are clearly making a big impact, and they should continue to increase in their utilization. That being said, I think the correctional healthcare team can have an even bigger impact by continuing to improve upon patient education and spending time with patients to understand and address their concerns. You know, because it's one thing to give a patient a medication that lasts a month, but it's another thing entirely to have that patient be motivated to come and receive the dose next month. You know, I was reading patient interviews in preparation for this episode, and one that stuck with me was with a gentleman, presumably with HIV. I'm kind of presuming by context clues, it wasn't directly stated, who spoke of quote unquote Dr. G and said, I'm paraphrasing, that he cared more for us by explaining everything. And I believe that he's the reason I'm still here, because he taught me more about my disease. He taught me that if I skip doses, the virus can figure out the medication and the medication won't work for me anymore. So changing a patient's attitude toward their disease and medication not only improves their adherence while incarcerated, but can also help more in the long term, you know, when it comes to their eventual reentry into the community.
It goes a long way, all the efforts that you detailed. So
at the end of the day, it kind of, I am all for pharmacological technology. I think it's fantastic, and I think we need more of it in this space. But I think what it all boils down to is, at the end of the day, you can't really replace the human element and the human touch.
Exactly.
Metaphorically speaking.
Yep. That's a message to all the AI pharmacy entrepreneurs out there.
Exactly. Keep us employed, right?
Right. We'll be right back with some trivia capsule.
In the realm of corrections health, not all electronic health records are created equally. Sapphire EHR is a comprehensive, cloud-based electronic health record designed specifically for correctional health providers. Since 2011, Sapphire has worked one-on-one with healthcare staff in jails and prisons to develop and refine a suite of features and modules to manage total inmate patient care. From MedPass to dental care, to documentation of lab results and creating custom forms, Sapphire's correction-specific features can be scaled to meet the needs of the largest correctional facilities down to the smallest local jails. And it's all backed up by 100% in-house hosting, training, and support with a 24/7 help desk. Get a closer look at the Corrections EHR deployed in over 400 facilities across 36 states and territories. Visit www.sapphire-health.com and schedule a demo today. Sapphire EHR, cloud-based, compatible, correction-specific electronic health records. Now back to Podcast RX with Chris Bender.
All right, Chris, so you foreshadowed today's trivia capsule at the end of your discussion. You're going to take a look today at a type of medication that no doubt has helped improve adherence simply because it eliminates the need for frequent dosing. What do you got?
All right. So many long-acting injectables exist on the market today, and they're used for a variety of conditions. But have you ever wondered what the first long-acting injectable was? Well, penicillin G benzathine, commonly known as bicillin LA, revolutionized the treatment of bacterial infections in the mid-20th century. Penicillin itself was discovered by Alexander Fleming in 1928, but early formulations required frequent dosing due to rapid clearance from the body. This limited its use, especially for chronic or difficult-to-treat infections. To overcome this, scientists sought to develop a formulation that could maintain therapeutic levels of penicillin over extended periods. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, researchers introduced benzathine, a slowly soluble compound that formed a crystalline complex with penicillin G. This complex, known as penicillin G benzathine, could be injected intramuscularly, slowly releasing the antibiotic over several weeks. This sustained release property made it ideal for treating diseases like syphilis and rheumatic fever, where consistent antibiotic exposure is critical to eradication and prevention of complications. Penicillin G benzathine improved patients' adherence by reducing the need for frequent injections or oral doses. Its discovery marked a milestone in pharmacology, inspiring the development of other depot formulations and long-acting medications. Today, penicillin G benzathine remains a cornerstone in treating certain infections, namely syphilis, demonstrating the lasting impact of this innovative sustained release technology.
Would have never guessed penicillin was the jumping off point for the long acting injectables. That's really interesting. I just, you know, having no education in this area, I always assumed that penicillin was naturally efficacious.
Yeah. Well, if you ever taken it for a tooth infection or anything, four times a day dosing is very cumbersome for some. And
that's the other thing. I've never had to take it. So,
yeah. And interestingly about syphilis is you really have to keep at it. It is a it's a very dormant type of infection, and you need to continuously hammer it with sustained levels of medication. So even if you were perfectly adherent, I guess maybe you could do it with an oral penicillin, but I really, it really needs to be sustained. So that's why this was game changing whenever they came out with it. So,
and a total side note, penicillin G benzathine. I love the way that rolls off the tongue. It's like,
it's very poetic.
Yeah. It's like, and it's like a name, you know, I am penicillin G benzathine. You know?
Exactly. Or, the middle initial is just middle, G.
Yeah. It's like, yeah. Or it's like, I was thinking something like a 80s hip hop, name.
Okay. Yeah. I like
G-benzathine.
That.
Benzathine.
Yeah. It just gets confusing when you look it up online because sometimes it's penicillin G benzathine. Sometimes it's benzathine G penicillin. And we're not even getting, we're not even going to get into the other formulations of penicillin. Yeah. So.
Oh, wow. Very interesting stuff there. And, thanks again for that. Another great trivia capsule. But yeah, that brings us to the end of the show. And Chris, I want to thank you again for sharing your insights into the non-adherence in the correctional setting. I really enjoy these like nuts and bolts topics this way. And I'm looking forward to asking you more things about that as we get into our next episode. But man, so much happened in between then and now.
Yes, so. It is. I'm gearing up. You gear up for your lovely vacation and you enjoy yourself. You'll be sleeping. I'll be staying awake.
No, I don't know if I'll be sleeping, to be fair. You know, you put three kids in an unfamiliar room in a new house.
This is true too. Yeah.
So that we'll see how that all goes.
There you go.
But either way, I'm really like these discussions really speak to the challenges of the correctional medicine but also just the importance of the pharmacists and your importance of keeping patients healthy. So we're looking forward to that. Again, I want to just remind, if you like what we do, please make sure you're following us where you get podcasts. You can please leave or write us a review. You can get in touch via email, podcastrx, diamondpharmacy.com. Full show notes available, diamondpharmacy.com/resources/blog. Look for it there if you want to read more into anything that Chris talked about today. You got some jumping off points. So Chris, thanks again. So good to have you in person. We need to do this more often if we can time it out when you're in with your...
Exactly. That's the plan.
So I just want to sincerely wish you and your family the very best as you prepare to welcome another member to the Bender clan. And certainly be thinking of you all in the weeks ahead.
All right. Sounds good. I appreciate it. I'm always good chatting.
All right. Till next time.
All right. Take care.
Podcast RX features conversations with healthcare professionals. The statements and opinions discussed herein are for informational purposes only. This podcast should not be considered professional medical advice and should not be used as the substitute for the advice of an appropriately qualified and licensed healthcare professional. Therefore, listeners must not rely on the statements made herein.
Podcast RX is a production of Diamond Pharmacy Services. Find our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you enjoy podcasts. And where possible, please rate and review. If you'd like to get in touch with the show directly, shoot us an email at podcastrx@diamondpharmacy.com. Thank you again for your support.